So now it's time for the wonderful Peter Cushing to bring us the tale of an orphan who is invited to live with his elderly reclusive cousin in Lost Hearts.
It was September in the year 1811 that Stephen Elliot arrived in a postchaise at Aswarby Hall, Lincolnshire. He had been left an orphan 6 months before, and now, owing to the generous offer of his elderly cousin, Mr. Abney, he had come to live at Aswarby. The offer was unexpected, because all who knew anything of Mr. Abney looked upon him as a somewhat austere recluse, whose main interest appeared to be the religious beliefs of the later pagans. Certainly his library contained all the then available books bearing on the mysteries, the Orphic poems, the worship of Mithras, and the Neoplatonists. Mr. Abney, however, seemed inclined to give his young cousin a kindly reception. The moment the front door was opened, he darted out of his study, rubbing his hands with delight.
"How are you, my boy? How are you? How old are you?" he asked.
"I am pretty well, sir," said Master Elliot.
"That's a good lad," said Mr. Abney. "And how old are you, my boy?"
It seemed a little odd that he should have asked the question twice in the first 2 minutes of their acquaintance. "I'm 12 years old next birthday, sir," said Stephen.
"And when is your birthday, my dear boy?" 11th of September, eh? That's well, that's very well. Nearly a year hence, isn't it? I like to get these things down in my book. Take him to Mrs. Bunch's room, Parks, and let him have his tea."
Mr. Parks, the butler, conducted Stephen to the lower regions. Mrs. Bunch was the housekeeper, and she made Stephen feel completely at home. They quickly became great friends. Stephen spent most of his evenings sitting by the fire in Mrs. Bunch's room, reflecting on his new surroundings. "Is Mr. Abney a good man, and will he go to heaven?" he asked one evening while they were talking.
"Good? Oh, bless the child," said Mrs. Bunch. "Master's a kinder soul as ever I see. Didn't I never tell you of the little boy and the girl that he took in out of the street?"
"No."
"Well," said Mrs. Bunch, "the little girl I don't seem to recollect so much about. I know Master brought her back with him from his walk one day, and give orders that she should be took every care with. And the poor child had no one belonging to her. She told me so, her own self. And here she lived with us a matter of 3 weeks, it might be. And then, whether she was something of a gypsy in her blood or what not, but one morning, she out of her bed afore any of us had opened her eye, and neither track nor trace of her have I set eyes on since. Master was wonderful put about, and had all the ponds dragged, but it's my belief she was had away by the gypsies."
"And what about the little boy?" said Stephen.
"Oh, that poor boy," sighed Mrs. Bunch. "He were a foreigner. Giovanni, he called himself, and he came a-tweaking his hurdy-gurdy round and about the drive one winter day, and Master had him in that minute. But he went the same way with him. He was off one fine morning, just the same as the girl. Why he went and what he done was our question for as much as a year after, for he never took his hurdy-gurdy, and there it lays, on the shelf."
That night Stephen had a curious dream. At the end of the passage at the top of the house in which his bedroom was situated, there was an old, disused bathroom, and Stephen Elliot found himself, as he thought, looking through the door. The moon was shining through the window, and he was gazing at a figure which lay in the bath. A figure inexpressibly thin and pathetic, enveloped in a shroud-like garment, the hands pressed tightly over the region of the heart. The terror of the sight forced Stephen backwards, and he awoke to the fact that he was indeed standing on the cold, boarded floor of the passage in the full light of the moon. He went to the door of the bathroom to see if the figure of his dream was really there. It was not, and he went back to bed. Mrs. Bunch was much impressed next morning by his story, and Mr. Abney, moreover, to whom he confided his experiences at breakfast, was greatly interested and made notes of the matter in what he called his book. The following evening, Mrs. Bunch was occupying herself in mending his nightgown when...
"Oh, gracious me, Master Stephen," she broke forth rather irritably. "How do you manage to tear your nightdress out of Flinders this way?"
There was indeed a most destructive and apparently wanton series of slits or scorings in the garment. They were confined to the left side of the chest, long, parallel slits about 6 inches in length. Stephen could only express his entire ignorance of their origin. He was sure they were not there the night before. On the following evening, the usual duet of Stephen and Mrs. Bunch was augmented by the sudden arrival of Mr. Parks, the butler, who, as a rule, kept himself rather to himself in his own pantry. He did not see that Stephen was there.
"Master may get up his own wine, if he likes, of an evening," was his first remark. "Either I do it in the daytime or not at all, Mrs. Bunch. I don't know what it may be. Very like it's the rats, or the wind got into the cellars. But I keep hearing voices down there."
"Oh, what nonsense you do talk, Mr. Parks, not fit for children to listen to."
On seeing Stephen, Mr. Parks shut up quickly and refused to give a more detailed account of his experiences in the cellar. It was after luncheon on March the 24th, 1812, that Mr. Abney said,
"Stephen, my boy, do you think you could manage to come to me tonight as late as 11 o'clock in my study? Don't mention it to anyone. I shall be busy until that time, and I wish to show you something connected with your future life."
Stephen was excited and eagerly grasped at the opportunity of sitting up till 11 o'clock. At about 10 o'clock, Stephen was standing at the open window of his bedroom, looking out over the country. It had been a windy, noisy day, which filled the house and gardens with a restless impression, but now the air was still. From time to time, strange cries as of lost and despairing wanderers sounded from across the mere. They might be the notes of owls or water birds, yet they did not quite resemble either sound. Suddenly, he caught sight of two figures standing on the gravelled terrace that ran along the garden side of the hall, the figures of a boy and girl, as it seemed. They stood side by side, looking up at the windows. Something in the form of the girl recalled irresistibly his dream of the figure in the bath. The boy inspired him with more acute fear. He stood and raised his arms in the air with an appearance of menace and of unappeasable hunger and longing. The moon shone upon his almost transparent hands, and Stephen saw that the nails were fearfully long and that the light shone through them. On the left side of his chest there opened a black and gaping rent. In another moment this dreadful pair had moved swiftly and noiselessly over the dry gravel, and he saw them no more. Inexpressibly frightened as he was, he determined to take his candle and go down to Mr. Abney's study, for the hour appointed for their meeting was near at hand. His repeated knocks on the study door produced no answer. Mr. Abney was engaged. He was speaking. What? Why did he try to cry out? And why was the cry choked in his throat? Had he, too, seen the mysterious children? But now everything was quiet, and the door yielded to Stephen's terrified and frantic pushing. On the table in Mr. Abney's study, certain papers were found which explained the situation to Stephen Elliot when he was of an age to understand them. The most important sentences were as follows.
"It is recorded of Magus and Trismegistus that they were able to fly in the air, to become invisible, or to assume any form they pleased, by the absorption of the hearts of not less than 3 human beings below the age of 21 years. To the testing of the truth of this receipt, I have devoted the greater part of the last 20 years. The first step I effected by the removal of one Phoebe Stanley, a girl of gypsy extraction, on March the 24th, 1792. The second by the removal of a wandering Italian lad named Giovanni Paoli,
on the night of March the 23rd, 1805. The final victim, to employ a word repugnant in the highest degree to my feelings, must be my cousin Stephen Elliot. His day must be this March the 24th, 1812. The best means of effecting the required absorption is to remove the heart from the living subject. The remains of the first two subjects, at least, it will be well to conceal. A disused bathroom or wine cellar will be found convenient for such a purpose. Some annoyance may be experienced from the psychic portion of the subjects, which popular language dignifies with the name of ghosts. But the man of philosophic temperament, to whom alone the experiment is appropriate, will be little prone to attach importance to the feeble efforts of these beings to wreak their vengeance on him. Mr. Abney was found in his chair, his head thrown back and his face stamped with an expression of rage, fright, and mortal pain. In his left side was a terrible lacerated wound exposing the heart. There was no blood on his hands, and a long knife that lay on the table was perfectly clean. A savage wild cat might have inflicted the injuries. The window of the study was open, and it was the opinion of the coroner that Mr. Abney had met his death by the agency of some wild creature. But Stephen Elliott's study of the papers I have quoted led him to a very different conclusion.
That was Peter Cushing reading Lost Hearts by M.R. James. It was abridged by Doreen Estel, and the producer was Peter Estel.